So about 6 months ago, I joined the WCF team after we shipped MEF. And the primary reason that I joined was to work on evolving our HTTP story that we have for WCF. We already supported, starting with .NET 3.5, the ability to take your web services and expose them in kind of an HTTP-friendly way. Has anybody here used WCF HTTP, like WebGet, WebInvoke? Few? Okay. We hope that number is going to change. And so what we've been doing some deep investments to really try to take the platform forward. I'm going to talk a bit about that. But really, the focus I want to do on this talk is really around REST. And there's a lot of misnomers about what REST is, what REST isn't. So one of the goals for this talk is to really clarify what is REST in terms of technically versus how people use the term practically. And there's a huge difference. And that was one of the first things that really hit me as I joined the team, because we have previously done some work around REST. We shipped something called the REST Starter Kit. Anybody here heard of the REST Starter Kit? Okay. Wow, a lot of you haven't heard of it. And we got really good response on the REST Starter Kit. And so at that point, we kind of went out with a product that we were saying was for REST. And that had kind of a bit of an opinionated decision on how you build RESTful solutions. What we're trying to do now is, and as we'll see, is REST is really about HTTP. We want to have a proper platform for HTTP that will allow people who want to apply a RESTful architectural style to do that, but without us taking any hard opinions on what REST is, because there's a wide variance of opinion. But there's no variance of opinion on HTTP. As a matter of fact, there's a nice little RFC 2616 that defines exactly what HTTP is. And you need to use that to be able to apply REST. So the term I gave here, REST, it's more than just data. Why did I come with that terminology? As I mentioned, there's a lot of people that use this term REST and use this term with a very specific meaning that's not the meaning that the person who coined this term actually meant. And his name is Roy Fielding. He wrote a dissertation, and in that dissertation, he was talking about network architecture, and he spoke about representational state transfer. Do we have a clicky? No, we don't. Okay, so I'll use the keyboard. A lot of people use this term just to mean, I like to say, no soap, right? I've got a website, I've got some back end, I'm doing some Ajax stuff, for example, is one great scenario, and I just want to get stuff over the wire. And I want to do it in a pain-free manner. Any of you have done that? Tried to just send some data back from a web server to be consumed by a browser through some type of Ajax call? Okay, and this is really what like jQuery and things like this are about. Clicky, thank you, David. Take back everything I said about you. Thank you very much, David. So yeah, there's a lot of people that really think about REST as just give me a light way to send stuff over the wire. And they don't really care about the letters in the or what the term actually means, but they're really just saying, I don't want to pay all this friction cost, I don't want to have to deal with WSDL, I don't want to do all this other stuff. And so initially when I first came to WCF, I was thinking, well, that's really what I'm going to help build. I'm going to help build something that just lets you throw stuff over the wire any way you want to, without the shackles that you have to deal with of SOAP. Scott Hanselman's done a great presentation where he compares, like REST and SOAP. And he for SOAP, he uses like the Darth Vader and like the Empire, the Imperial fleet. Really, there's SOAP imposes a lot of rules that you have to abide by, but there's benefits to abiding by those rules. Whereas on the REST side, it's really about this freedom. But what I found as I started to engage with the REST community, not only within Microsoft, but the Java community, the Ruby community, there's a bunch of people that use this term that means something much more than just give it to me and send it over the wire. And they're really concerned about building these really enterprise-scale applications that are easy to maintain, As a matter of fact, it resonated a lot with a lot of the things we talk about in patterns and practices when we speak about things like composite applications, which are easy to evolve. Evolvability, separation of concerns, these are all things that are important to this community. And the body is not the most interesting part, meaning the fact that I can just send stuff over the wire without the shackles of silk. It's really about leveraging the headers and things that HTTP provides, which a lot of the server infrastructure that exists in the web actually uses. And it will give you greater scalability benefits if you leverage it yourself. So we'll just move forward. So this is the way the web works. Like if we look at the difference between HTTP, let's say, and REST, HTTP is a specification, it's a protocol. It's not a transport protocol solely. It's an application layer protocol that has these very rich semantics. We like to think about it commonly when we use a browser as, oh, it's just a way to pass HTML, but it's actually much more than that. And these are kind of the core components just to get you up to speed on like what is within an HTTP request or an HTTP response. What does the protocol define? So it has a set of parameters. It has messages and headers, which we talked about. It has methods, which is the idea that, you know, any resource that I have that's exposed on the web is accessible through a set of HTTP methods, otherwise known as verbs. Get, post, delete, put. It has a set of status codes. It has this concept called content negotiation. How many people here have actually heard of ConEgg, what ConEgg is? ConEgg basically means that when you go back to the web server and you say, get me something, it doesn't have to only give it to you in HTML. You may be used to the fact that when you use a browser, the default that everything comes back in is HTML. But servers are actually designed, and the HTTP spec defines this concept called negotiation, which allows me to send headers to the server that say, here are the types of representations I can support in my browser, or even if I'm not a browser, and the server does this negotiation process and says, oh, okay, based on what you've asked me for, this is what I can give you. So, for example, I could go ask for a PDF, and I'll get a PDF back. I could go ask for an image, and I'll get an image back. And all of this is understood really within the core protocol itself. But when we use protocols like SOAP, that shields all that information because it encapsulates within the body this whole new protocol and way of representing things, but everything is really XML. So we get this full flexibility of formats. For example, you could go to a website and have it return to you a click once manifest. You could go and have it return a text file. This is all the kinds of things that content negotiation enables. And why it's interesting is because when I get back something that just says XML, that just means it's an XML document. I can look at the schema and get some information about it, but for example, if I go and ask for a PDF, that PDF comes back with a very defined set of semantics around it. And there's a spec somewhere that says, hey, if your media type is a PDF, then this is how you work with it. Well, what folks in the REST community really are interested in is saying, well, we can create our own media types. We can use this ability for content negotiation that HTTP provides for us. We can create our own media types that have this very specific semantics to our application domain. We'll look at that a bit later. Caching is another key one. All the infrastructure of the web has this notion of how to cache requests. So built into the HTTP protocol is the idea of caching. Well, in order to leverage the benefits of that caching, you have to utilize the protocol directly. And when you're doing things like just plain old JSON, plain old XML, you're not doing that. You're just using the body. There's also authentication, etc. So this is HTTP. It has nothing to do with REST. It's just a protocol. REST, however, is the way the web uses HTTP. And when I say the web, I mean the infrastructure of the web, all the servers. The REST thesis that Roy Fielding wrote was basically he was writing a paper that was saying, why does the web scale the way that it does? It's the most scalable application, the most scalable system in existence. And he looked at, because he was one of the co-authors of HTTP, he looked at what were the constraints that we put in place that allowed this type of scale? Because HTTP is just this really wide protocol. And that is what became known as REST. REST is a set of constraints that are applied to get the scalability and evolvability benefits that the web itself gives us. And what kind of benefits do we get? One of the benefits we get is simplicity. One of the reasons we get simplicity is because in SOAP world, we have a WSDL file. And that WSDL file defines different operations. So I can't just arbitrarily walk up to any SOAP service that happens to be hanging off of HTTP and start working. I have to get that WSDL file. And that WSDL file defines a whole bunch of information. And then I have to encode myself in a very specific format within that SOAP message to be able to play in this game. But the web introduces, and what HTTP introduces, the concept of applying a uniform interface. The uniform interface means that whatever resource I go to, it's going to support one of these HTTP methods, get, post, delete, etc. That means I don't need a WSDL file. I can just go, any URI you give me, I know how to work with it. Now, that resource may not support all of the verbs. It may only support a subset. It may say you can only call get on me, but you can't actually post to me. But even that is discoverable because the HTTP spec defines a special type of verb called options. And with options, I can go ask the server and query it and say, what verbs do you understand? But this idea of this uniform interface brings this simplicity because we now have a standard way to approach any resource that's available out on the web without any kind of special tooling or anything, which is what we need in the case of WSDL. The visibility of HTTP is because if everything is put out there as URIs, those URIs are discoverable. Search engines can find them. All this information is available for you to find. Also, the visibility comes because of the fact that you're separate. In SOAP, there is no visibility to the web because it's just this chunk of XML stuff that an XML, you know, that a SOAP parser can understand and look for these envelopes. But with HTTP, when I put stuff in the headers, when I say my content type equals blah, when I say my HTTP method equals blah, when I say my accept headers are this, all this information is now available for the server infrastructure of the web to take advantage of and to optimize on. For example, one of the headers is called entity tag. Has anybody heard of the entity tag? Entity tag is built into the web. It's there all the time. You just don't realize it. Entity tag is a unique identifier that any request that you send to the server, it can give you back a response with an entity tag. And what that entity tag says is the next time that you want to get this, you can use this tag ID and the server infrastructure, you can ask it in a conditional way, is this tag ID still valid? And if this tag ID is still valid, then the server will just return to you a response that says, just use the one that you have. I don't need to send you another one. If it's changed, then it will send you a new one with a new ID. But where it gets interesting is the fact that any server in the middle on the way to that destination server can look at that e-tag and can say, I've got that. I've got a cache of that. This is how all that local caching that we get when we use the web today, all those cache servers work. They all work off of these e-tag IDs as these versioning identifiers. So that gives you better performance. Scalability, we're going to talk about how you can use this thing called hypermedia, and we're going to get to that in a minute, to actually allow apps to scale out where you can make some significant changes to where things are located and it doesn't have any effect whatsoever to the client. REST also has this stateless aspect to it, the idea that I keep all of the state, all of the application state, off of the server. That means, again, I get this much greater scale. And I get much greater performance because of things like caching, etc. And the modifiability is the fact that when I start to use this hypermedia, which we're going to talk about, I can actually make dramatic changes to where things are located. I can add new things into my system, and I don't break existing clients. Plus, I can have capabilities that are actually even discoverable to existing clients if I put in the effort to build adaptable clients, which is a whole other discussion. So Do you understand the difference between REST and HTTP itself in terms of conceptually? Anybody? Right, so REST, think of it as just REST is one prescribed way to use HTTP, but it's the way that all of our servers and stuff that are out there on the web use HTTP. So REST has a set of constraints. What are those constraints? One is the notion of client-server, the idea that you're sending a request to the server sending you a response back. That's a core part of REST, right? It's this idea that there's this client-server relationship. Stateless, I already talked about. Cacheable, I already talked about. The fact that these requests and stuff can be cached. But the caching, you don't get all this stuff for free. You have to apply all of these constraints. You can apply parts of the constraints, but let me give you an example. The uniform interface defines, in the HTTP spec, it defines that certain methods are safe and certain methods are idempotent. An idempotent operation is one that if you call it multiple times, there's not going to be any side effects. So as an example, a GET operation is considered safe and idempotent. Safe means it doesn't make any change to the data. It doesn't cause any change in state. Whereas idempotent means you can call it multiple times and it won't cause any side effects. So an example of an operation that is idempotent but that is not safe is put. The put verb translates traditionally to kind of an update. So when you call put the first time, it's actually going to cause some update to happen. But if you call, well, it may cause an update to happen, depending on how it's been implemented. But it means it's saying that it's very possible when you call put, some state is going to change on the server state. If I call put five times, though, it's the same result, right? If I update to five, and I call update to five times, or I update to five 10 times, that's going to be a safe result. Post, on the other hand, is actually not safe at all or idempotent. If I call post 5 times, that's 5 new entries that have been added to a collection. But get is the key one. Get is safe and idempotent. I can call get as many times as I want. There should be no side effects. There should be no side effects and it doesn't cause any kind of modifications. So why is that interesting? Because the caching infrastructure of the web really cares about GET. It says, if you've given me a GET request, then I know I can safely just return to you a cached copy because it's not going to, I know what the result of that GET is because somebody else did it over here, just going to return it, no problem. But if you give me a POST request, I don't know what to do with that. I'm just going to pass it along because you're actually telling me that you're going to modify some state. So I have no way of knowing what that is. I'm just going to let it go. Well, guess what protocol SOAP likes to use? Anybody have an idea? What protocol does SOAP use? POST. So right there, you lose a lot of those caching benefits when you go down the SOAP model because of that fact. It doesn't mean you can't do any kind of caching. You can have specialized SOAP servers that do caching. But what I mean is the infrastructure of the web, you lose that caching. Now, here's another problem. Let's say you're doing gets, but you're doing gets, and you're sending variables in the query string that are actually causing updates to the data. So now the system thinks that you're doing an operation that is safe and idempotent, but you're actually not using it in a way that is safe and idempotent because you're actually causing a modification. So it can't really, doesn't, it thinks it can cache that data, but actually it can't because you're actually causing, these value changes. So what people will do is they won't send the e-tag. If the server doesn't see the e-tag, it's not going to try to do any caching. It's just going to keep going ahead. And there's a well-known problem that this caused in the industry. Because all these web servers out there, all these websites that people were building were allowing you to do modifications to data based on GET. When Google first launched its web crawler, this is a well-known thing that happened many, many years ago, they were thinking, well, GET is safe and idempotent. So they were walking all the different links, and they deleted everybody's blogs. Because all those blogs were exposing their API as a GET. So the act of pulling on that GET, which should have been safe and idempotent, actually calling on a link that was delete, for example, with a GET, caused, guess what? That got deleted. So really the idea here is if you play by this game, if you play by the rules, you get a lot of benefits. Code on demand basically means that on the web in particular, you have JavaScript, for example. So the server can push down logic as necessary to the client. The thing that, and that gives you better maintainability because of the fact that, you know, if there are changes, the code just gets updated. In a desktop application, and a desktop application could also be speaking over HTTP. Don't think it's only a browser. You don't have this benefit. So the problem you have with a desktop application, if there's any kind of coupled logic, and you want to make any kind of changes to things, like you want to change URIs, et cetera, that client breaks unless it gets redeployed, unless you've architected it in the right way. And we'll talk about what the right way is in a second. So that's what these constraints are. Let me just get my... I want to make sure I keep track of time. Okay, so in terms of, we defined what REST is, we defined what HTTP is, and there's a lot of gamut in between, right? And some have used this term high REST, low REST, which makes people in the REST community incensed. Because they basically say, look, REST is a set of principles, it's like being part of a club. And it's not about elitism, it's saying that in order to get the benefits that the web brings, you've got to do all these constraints that were described. One of them is optional, which is the code on demand. So they get really bent out of shape when you say, like, low REST. They say, what? REST is REST, right? It is black and white. Now, there's still margins in between, but they say that these core principles, for example, Roy says this is what defines what REST is. Not to say that using a subset of those is bad, just don't call it REST. Use the subset all day long, nobody will care. It's when you say, oh, I'm doing this and I'm calling it RESTful, that's when you'll get people that will have a disagreement. And you may or may not care about that, but that's just explaining the way it is. So Richardson, Leonard Richardson wrote this book called RESTful Web Services. It's a very good book. I really recommend it. And there's another really good book that's just come out called REST in Practice, which is really about taking this model and applying it in the enterprise beyond the browser. But one of the things that Richardson did is he said, rather than use this low REST, high REST term, let's clarify how people use HTTP with a maturity model that has different levels to it. Right? And at the top of the level, which you see there is hypermedia, which you can tell, you know, being that it's a pyramid, less people are doing that. That's really the kind of pure REST model. And in between, there are stages. And there's value, you know, going up that continuum is great. But he's just moving the conversation off of low REST, high REST, to saying this is about HTTP and how you use it. That really resonates with me as well, because I think at the end of the day, so many people get caught up on this term REST when really it is about an application of HTTP. So let's look at what this maturity model means, and we'll use an example. So let's use an order processing system. And let's not think about it from the browser, because I want people to, when you think about REST and you think about HTTP, the primary use case for REST today and when the server, for at least how the server infrastructure of the web was built, was for serving web pages, right? But nothing about the practices requires that. So you can totally have two devices just talking to each other in a RESTful way. If they're talking over the web, you get this scale and other stuff if you play by the rules. And now we're all moving to the cloud. So, you know, moving to the cloud and Azure and EC2 and all this other stuff, it's all on the web. So why shouldn't we want to leverage those benefits that the web infrastructure brings to us? So Richardson came up with this maturity model, as I mentioned, and then Fowler kind of translated it, Martin Fowler, into more explicit non-technical terms. So the first level he called the swamp of POX. Now this is Fowler's definition of level zero. Richardson calls level zero just URIs. But the swamp of POX, POX meaning plain old XML, if you think about an order service, an order system that's been exposed, if I go in the SOAP world, for example, or just XML over RPC, the idea is I have this one URI, order service, or in the case of WCF, orderservice.svc. It's one verb, post, everything's over one verb, and it's one URI. Everything is actually encapsulated in the message, the SOAP message, and something has to understand, something not being the web infrastructure, has to understand how to pull that apart. So it's not very friendly for browsers, first off, because of the fact that, you know, I'm not going to go into my browser and how am I going to create this SOAP message from my browser? I can't really do that. Meaning I can write JavaScript code that does that, but I'm talking about meaning me being able to copy a URI and just drop it in my browser and see what's there. So I can't do that. I don't get those caching benefits because it's all over post. I don't get the discoverability benefits because it's all in a single URI. I don't get the simplicity benefits because I need to have the WSDL file to get it all down. It works, but this is not really getting using the benefits of HTTP. And there's a reason for that, because it wasn't designed for HTTP. SOAP could be passed over TCP. SOAP could be passed over FTP as a file. SOAP could be passed over MSMQ. It just looks at the fact, you know, it says, I've got this handled. Just put me in some type of transport and, you know, whoever's on either side of the call will take care of it. So that's really what we do today with web services. The next level is where I start to expose different aspects of my system as individual URIs. So here you can see that now my create, my update, my submit, delete, cancel, approve, find, they're all separate resources. Actually, let me go back for 1 second. The other thing that's not here is because I'm using one verb, right? The servers can't, the idempotent safe, they can't make any decisions based on that because they have no visibility into what my intent is. Once we get to resources, we now get some more visibility. We get some more browser friendliness from a navigation perspective. I can go into a browser. I can put this URI in. And I do get some more benefit in terms of now I can add new things to the system that are new URIs. I don't have to modify some existing WSDL file or anything like that. So it's a step in the right direction. Right? And there's a lot of the... there's a lot of REST quote services out there now. If you go on programmableweb.com, they're actually doing this. They're basically saying, "Hey, I've got a, you know, it's RPC though, right? It's remote procedure call model. I'm literally correlating for each of my methods that are in my objects. I'm just exposing a resource that correlates to that method. So it's a very programmatic kind of linkage there. When the reality of it is, HTTP just knows about resources, and a resource could be anything. Nothing about HTTP says that that resource needs to point to a class or a method or a file. It doesn't care. It's completely open. All it says is that, hey, if you come to me and request something, I'm going to give you back a response, and I'm going to use this content negotiation thing we talked about so that you can determine what representation you want, and I can help to, you know, service that request for you. And this one, by the way, WCF does pretty well because it's just simply with our WebGet stuff, we made it really easy to just throw this stuff over and yeah. The next level is where you start to use verbs. You start to use the HTTP methods. So now, instead of me having to know that there's a place that I'm going to go to called like update order, I just know that an order is a resource. Now we've moved from an RPC model to a resource-based model. I have a resource called an order. That order resource has on it a uniform interface. Why? Because everything over HTTP has this uniform interface. Now, you can break that uniform interface if you start creating custom methods, custom HTTP methods, which the HTTP spec does allow. But the point is, now when I see order /1234, I automatically know, cool. So get gets me that. Put updates, delete deletes. I didn't need a WSDL file to tell me. I can even know how to formulate the URI from that point, because it's the same exact URI of the resource I got back when I asked for it from the server, and now I've got what I need. Now, the next question becomes, how do I deal with things like methods, things that would normally be thought of from an RPC perspective? Well, you can represent those as resources as well, because resources can have children. So here I have this order 1234 resource, but it actually has submit, cancel, approve child resources. So it's still a resource, but it's a resource that when I post something to it is actually going to result in a change happening on the system. That's actually fine. There's nothing wrong with that. The thing is, though, to work in this system, I still have to know what are the types of things it can do. I still have to know, like, how to, and I have to know how to build URIs. I have to know to do submit, well, I'm going to go to 1234, I'm going to go to whatever my order ID is, slash submit. And the downside to that is, especially if we think about desktop clients, but it even affects you on the web client, because code demand still means you're having to change code. It means if a new operation appears, if there's a new resource, I'll call it an action resource. If a new action resource appears, then I need to teach my clients how to call that action resource. And they're coupled, they end up getting coupled to the URI of that thing. So this is certainly better than the previous, because now we do get to leverage a lot of those caching benefits, right? Because now we're actually obeying the rules about item potency and about safe methods. And the server can make, we can start to use e-tags and things at this level. The server can start to make decisions for us. The last level, and this was kind of, when I first started engaging with or getting involved with the REST community, there's one guy from the Java community who worked on this Java framework called Jersey. His name is Jan Algermeisen. He also worked on the JAX RS spec, which is a kind of REST spec in the Java world for doing REST on Java. And after I had been kind of involved with the community for about 2 months, he said to me, you know, what was the most kind of defining moment for you? Like, you've been learning a lot. What really has changed your perception about what REST is? And I said it was this. It was hypermedia. Hypermedia was like an aha moment, which we're going to talk about in a second, what the heck that means. So here, this looks like the previous slide, right? Nothing different. The difference is that instead of me having to now know what are the types of things that I can do on this resource, what are the types of capabilities it supports, aside from the uniform interface, that I know. I know I can check to see if it does delete or post or put, is it gives me information in the response. And this is where custom media types become important. So hypermedia is, Roy Fielding defined this term HadiOS, hypermedia as the engine of application state. Say that 10 times fast. What HadiOS means is that through the usage of linking, you can decouple your clients from knowing anything about where things are located or even what's available, having static information about what's available. And it puts the server in complete control to determine what are the next steps that are allowable for any particular request at any point in time. So, for example, if you look here, you can see that for submit, my response actually, and I'll show you the full response in a second, contains this link that is tagged with some metadata. There's a rel tag there, and that rel tag says submit. And it has a link. But the link can be completely opaque as far as I'm concerned. All my client has to know is there a submit link? Ah, there's a submit link. Great. I'm just going to grab the URI and invoke it and do a request against it. Now, you notice that that URI actually contains within it the order number. So this is where the statelessness comes in. I don't need session state. It's already encoded with all the information it needs. The server fully set that up so that now my client, even though it's completely disconnected, at some point in time can actually go and do that submit. So now my client no longer has to have the logic of knowing that orders in this state can be submitted. All it knows is let me see if there's a submit link present. If there's a submit link present, then I know I can enable the submit button. Now, submit here, by the way, it's overloaded. I don't mean like a form submit. I mean submit the order to be processed, right? I've created an order in the order system. The order needs to be approved. Then it's going to go through a processing. So that's what I mean here by submit. In the same way, okay, that should say approve. That rel should say approve. So this rel here, that's metadata, right? I'm basically utilizing metadata so that my client just knows about the metadata. It doesn't have to know about the specifics. And why that really becomes handy is from a scale perspective, if the server feels that such and such server is overloaded, it can say when I did that request, you're going to go here, you're going to go here, you're going to go here. So it, my client doesn't have to know how to build URIs. It doesn't have any logic whatsoever of building URIs. It simply knows how to grab that. Now, one of the things they've introduced into the HTML, they're doing a spec right now, is this concept called URI templates. In WCF, we actually have the ability when you tag a method that you can attach a template to it. And that template says, if my URI is contact slash contact ID or order slash bracket order ID, pull this variable out and give it to me. Well, there's a spec right now to actually make that be a first-class customer in terms of HTTP so that my client could give me a template, and then I would know to say, oh, I just need to give it the order ID, and that's the URI that it sends to. And that's to allow some more sophisticated scenarios. But today, this totally works. The server does the encoding. My client is just dumb. So how does this actually look? So this is what the server request would give me back. And you can see on the bottom, so I have order details comment there. Imagine all the other details about the order. But on the bottom, I have these links. And I'm using Atom because Atom defines a link element with a certain set of semantics, and you can mix those. You use those within. So I'm using the Atom reference there, and I'm saying, hey, I've got this thing called submit, here's its link. I got this thing called approve, here's its link. I've got this thing called cancel, here's its link. The type is actually a hint. It's not a requirement. The type is a way to hint that the thing that you send me should be this media type. Does that make sense?
And this comes down to be called get in the first place?
Yes, exactly. Yes? Say that again?
The submit, approve, cancel.
Yes, because they're not safe, because they're not safe operations. They actually cause their post.
Well, this question, post, where is that information that it has to be a post?
Yes. So there's difference of, okay. So good, very good question. So the question he had was, where is the information that it has to be a post? That information, so look at the content type there. That content type doesn't say application slash XML. That content type says application slash vnd.contoso.orders plus XML. There's a huge difference. So I talked about earlier this idea of content negotiation and how HTTP is really rich and lets me represent things whatever way I want. And today, if I get something back called HTTP, I mean to HTML, text slash HTML, how do I know what that means? Does anybody know? Like if I was brand new and I got back this thing that said text slash HTML, how would I figure out what the markup within that text HTML means? What was that?
HTML spec.
HTML spec. Perfect. Same way here. These will have a spec and optimally be registered with IANA. And in that spec, it will actually define all the specific semantics about this media type. It will say, I define links using the Atom link format. It will say, these are the links that you should expect to see. It will say, these are the verbs that you should use, the HTTP methods. Now, there is an alternative. The alternative is I could actually do an HTTP options against that link, taking advantage of the uniform interface, and ask the server what methods are supported. And it would give me back a list saying, oh, only post is supported. Or maybe post and get are supported, because get lets me check the status if the order approval has actually finished, whereas post is to actually put a new approval request in. Does that make sense? Christoph?
Yes.
Okay. So, yes.
Can you create arbitrary mime types?
Absolutely. Yeah, mime is a bad word. Nobody uses mime anymore. Media type. Yes, that is exactly the idea. Now, that raises a question of explosion of media types. And so I'm free to create private media types within my organization. If it's a closed kind of system, you can still register those with IANA. There's a branch of the IANA registry that nobody actually looks at, other than it's a place for you to just dump stuff that you want to put it there as an FYI so people could look it up. But this is one of the huge debates. This is like the most conversations I've had on that REST discussion. Well, actually, I usually turn it off. But the most discussions that occur over that REST discussion list is over this media type thing, and should they be registered with IANA or not, and is it not RESTful? You'll think these are people that have way too much time on their hands. Does it make it not RESTful if I apply all the constraints but I didn't register it in the IANA registry? And some say yes, and some say no, because they say that IANA, from the HTTP perspective, the only way to get full discoverability of what a media type is to have a registry, which Roy Fielding defined that you should have a registry, and IANA is the only one. So they argue, well, no, you're not RESTful, even if you look the most RESTful in the world, but you don't have yourself registered as a media type. But there's a lot of people that feel that those people are totally full of it, and they just need to come off their high horse. And so it's up to you, decide which one. But the importance, I think, here is that now it allows, rather than me just... So XML schema, by the way, doesn't capture this kind of information. XML schema only knows about the structure. It doesn't have any semantic meaning behind what these elements actually are. It just says you can have 0 or 1, or you can have this list. That's whereas if you look at the RFC 2616, it's a very long and boring explanation of like what HTTP is, or you have the equivalent HTML spec. So that's the idea here. Now this satisfies some of what we use WSDL for, in the sense that it now gives us a place to see the structure. And by the way, it's not mutually exclusive. You could still have a schema. When I go to this, it might tell me, look at this schema for the structure. But the semantic meaning, what verbs to use, what does this do actually in the system, how do I know how to actually use this API, that's all going to be defined in that spec. Yes? Oh. Okay. So then the question becomes, if I want to build systems like this, how can I do it? Today, for example, if you try to use our SOAP stack, well, that's not going to work because that's all SOAP. Now, with our web HTTP stuff, you could technically do this, but you would literally have to drop down to a stream in your code to get the encoding of the media type that you want, which is not optimal. So there's been a lot of frameworks. There's been a lot of momentum in the community around making it easier for people to build systems like this. I'm going to quote a few names for you, and then I'm going to show you what we're doing in WCF. Because we care about this. Like, when we look at what we have today, and we say, like, if this is really... Because the benefits you get here, if you buy into it, the benefits that you get here are tremendous. Because now my clients are completely decoupled. Now, that doesn't mean my clients have no knowledge. See, the problem, like with WSDL, if you generate a proxy off a WSDL file, that's a snapshot in time. So one of the things this opens up the possibility to do, and if you read the REST in Practice book, they actually, Ian Robinson and Jim Weber and Savis, who works at Microsoft, and it's a great book, they show how you can build these evolvable clients that actually learn about new features. Now, you may say, well, how could you do that? Well, we do it today with the browser, right? If I go to Bing or Yahoo or Google, and it gives me back a set of links, and let's say I have a profile, and based on that profile, it knows what to give me. As a human being, I can look at that and can understand, there's some new thing there. It says star new. I can, you know, it's highlighted. It's something cool. I can pick it. So this hypermedia thing is already there with all the web pages. The challenge is, what does it mean when I'm now building code that talks to one another? How do I do that? So there's two opinions. So the REST in Practice opinion is you can actually build these adaptable clients, which gets kind of abstract, but it's the idea that those clients have no hard knowledge. They may know about the fact that there are things called links that I have to look for, but they don't have any hard knowledge of what those links are, and they learn that on the fly. And they show a way that you can do it. I think mere mortals are not ready for it yet, but it is definitely really interesting stuff about the types of things it enables. But in terms of what you'll see people do more practically, they may still have a snapshot in time, may have some class. They don't need a SOAP proxy, but they may have a class that encapsulates something that they're going to look at. Or if you look at what folks are doing in the Ruby world, which is dynamic languages, they'll say, I give you some class that if you put like approve on it, then it knows automatically to look for an approve link. So it still allows you to be, you don't need anything hard-coded as far as generated for you, because it's a dynamic language, but you could write in your code .approve and we'll know that that means you want me to look in the result that came back to look for an approve link and call it. RESTfully, so remember RESTfully. RESTfully is in Ruby, Java, and .NET. And RESTfully as a framework was built basically to deliver a framework that was based on the concepts that Ian and Jim and those guys laid out in REST in practice. So it provides a really nice way, and it supports dynamic in C Sharp. Open Rasta is another one. Open Rasta allows you to define these things called, he lets you define your own media types, codecs. Codecs really are like media type formatters. So Open Rasta has this resource oriented approach. I'm not going to show you code for Open Rasta, but I'll just tell you that it goes very strictly against an RPC style approach and says you define resources in your system. And once you define resources in your system, you have these codecs to define different representations. Well, those representations could then contain hypermedia in them, which would now allow this type of thing to be possible. So the next question then would be, what are we doing? So as I mentioned, you could kind of support hypermedia today in WCF, but you'd have to do a lot of work to do it because by default, we really only understand the XML serializer and the JSON serializer, but the serializers that we have are really about data contracts. Because today, you know, when you use WCF, it has this fundamental concept called the data contract, and it says, hey, I can represent it in a lot of different ways, but it doesn't let you fully leverage all the aspects of XML or JSON that you would like to. So what we want to do is make formats a first-class customer and say, in WCF, you can represent things any way you want to. If you want to represent it as a text file, if you want to represent it as an image, you can actually do that. And I'll show you a quick demo. And then I will show you how you would actually set that up. Now, what I'm going to show you, just to be full disclosure, is not going to have hypermedia in it. I was working on a sample, which for some reason wasn't working. I will show you what the sample was so you can see what we're going to enable. But this will show it actually working, so you know it's not completely smoke and mirrors. So here what we have is this contact manager application, and it's using jQuery. One of the challenges, and it's talking to WCF on the back end, or WCF vNext on the back end. jQuery by default, even if you use JSON, by default jQuery, when it does a post, it doesn't use JSON. It uses a URI form encoding. It uses the same encoding that you get when you do a post on a form. Why does it do that? The reason it does that is because all the browsers that are out there, they understand how to encode. Even though JavaScript supports JSON, browsers don't automatically encode in JSON. They know how to decode JSON. And that's why you have libraries like json2.js if you're using jQuery. But that bloats the size. So if I'm on a mobile device, I might not want that. So what jQuery does by default is when it does a post, it encodes it in this URI format, but it's that, you know, that the browser understands, but it's actually in the post. Well, so for WCF to talk to that today, it can't do it because it says, well, I will talk JSON or I will talk XML. So we want to make that easier. So this particular example is actually, when I do a post, is actually going to talk using the form encoding. But I also talked about this idea of richness of representations beyond just markup. So here I have a link. I don't know if you can see it on the bottom there, but it says, I will read it to you. It says on the bottom, localhost, blah, 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 contacts/69. So I'm going to copy that into my browser. And now I get an image. So this is what HTTP allows me to do. This is not an HTML page. This is literally that response returned an image. So did I write a lot of image code within my component? Well, let's take a look. So here's my contact resource, and here's my get. Yes. Is that better? Can you see that? So let's run it again.
Is that a state of the Lightforms project?
Yes. And I'm using routes. So in .NET 4.0, I'll show you that. In .NET 4.0, we added routes. Okay, so let's copy it again. Okay, so what you see here is so this is our syntax today, which is going to get better in the future. You know, you basically attribute your types with these web-get attributes. Has anybody seen web-get before? Okay, web-get, basically what this says is this is not a traditional SOAP service. This is going to be exposed over HTTP. And here when I use a web-get, I say that this particular method is going to get exposed as a get. And the URI template is a way that lets me map from the query string. Now, you notice I haven't put the actual URI there, so how does it know how to route it? Well, in .NET 4, we added the ability to integrate with ASP.NET routing, minimally at this point, but it's still nice because it gets rid of the SVC file. So here's where I've specified the URI. This would work today. Okay, so I'm saying I want to pull out the ID. There's the ID. I'm just creating a contact, which I'm going to my contact repository on. Let me process can't be accessed. Okay, how much time do we have? Okay. All right, then I'll just jump to this. How did that work? What we're doing in WCF is I'll just be very raw. We're making deep investments to make HTTP to allow you to access HTTP in a very rich way. And one of the ways we're doing that is we're adding this HTTP request response pipeline. And that pipeline allows you, it's a composable thing that allows you to tap in and say, as the request is being processed on the way to my operation, there's things I want to do. And on the response, there's things I want to do. So one of the things I want to be able to do is handle any media type that comes in. I want to have the option of saying, I can handle that. I know how to represent when I see this contoso, blah, blah, blah. Same thing with the response. I know how to take a request for an image and give you an image. So here you see that I've written a PNG formatter. Just take two more minutes and I'll be done. And that PNG formatter, it inherits, it's this media type processor. I tell it, hey, here's the types of media types I support. And here I do write to stream. That's the only thing I have to implement, write to stream. I'm taking the instance and I'm casting it as an eye contact. So I created this interface. And then based on that, I'm going to go out and find the image. And I'm just going to write to the response stream, which was passed in to me, the image, which you can see here. But I don't have to only work with the stream. I can actually get access to the full HTTP message. The last piece is, how do I configure that? And this is something we've heard a lot of feedback in WCF on, you know, configuration. And we have a lot of stuff that today that's in web config, et cetera. We're moving towards more of a code-based configuration model. That's what we're exploring right now. So if you look here, I have this thing called a host configuration class, which you'll see I'm passing in my route when I configure my routes. And that gives me these methods called create request processors, create response processors. That will run for every single operation that I have. Not every single message, every single operation. And it gives me a place to programmatically apply either global things across the board to all my services or all my operations, or to scope down. So here you can see that the first thing I did was say, I don't want you to support XML, get rid of it. So I called clear media type processors. I added my own JSON processor in the request that handles that URI form encoding. In the response, I said, I'm going to clear the processors and just support this image format, but I can also support the image format and JSON. This is just a small hint of the kind of stuff that we're going to do, but we think it's actually huge. Because now what I'm able to do is I can configure based on my resource hierarchy. When these methods run per operation, I get all the information about the operation, like what are the parameters, so I could do things like model binding if I want to pull things out and plug those in. I can look at the URI template. So if I want to do resource hierarchies where foo bar and say, hey, anything that matches on this regex of foo gets these processors added to it. And what you can do in those processors is literally anything you want. You have full access to the request, full access to the response, modify headers, modify content, etc. This is just the first big thing that we're doing. We have a longer term vision, but I've gone out over on time, so I'm going to have to close out. Thank you very much for your patience. Here's a couple of references, and I'll stay around for a bit if anybody has questions.